Welcome to The Great Security Debate. This show has experts taking sides to help broaden understanding of a topic. Therefore, it's safe to say that the views expressed are not necessarily those of the people we work with or for. Heck, they may not even represent our own views as we take a position for the sake of the debate. Our website is greatsecuritydebate.net, and you can contact us via email at feedback@greatsecuritydebate.net or on Twitter @securitydebate. Now, let's join the debate already in progress.
So I was talking with a buddy of mine in security, and he asked me why I'm not on Twitter. He goes, I can understand if you don't want to be on Facebook. He goes, but that's where all the big breaking news comes in. He goes, I mean, if you're talking about whether it's, you know, some new tool you can use, whether it's some type of ransom, like literally like went through like five different things. I go, no, I totally understand. I go, but that's why I rely on people like you to then take the Twitter and then announce it on LinkedIn so I can read it there. And he started laughing.
It's a filtration service.
Exactly. I go, if it's really juicy, I go, you'll end up sharing it. The only problem is if you actually share the Twitter feed, then all I can read is the headline. I actually can't click it. And then I got to go search for it on my own.
Or just sign up and give in. And I say this, yeah, is somebody who has shunned Facebook for 4 years and all Facebook products. By the way, quick aside, if you run an Oculus system, apparently after October, you're going to have to use a Facebook ID. Oculus, Palmer Luckey had proclaimed that Oculus users would never be required to have a Facebook ID. Well, with all things Facebook, we know that all things come back to the common slurping of data. So if you have Oculus, either get rid of it by October, and all new products after October, which I'm sure one will miraculously appear on October 31st, will require Facebook IDs from the start. So it's gotta love when data comes together and all things become Facebook.
It's funny when you mention Facebook too, because you look at the change that Google made in its business model, and a lot of that was spearheaded because of Facebook and the taking of market share. Mm-hmm. And as Facebook garnered all that market share and advertising dollars were being moved, it was, okay, we need to find a way, you know, the idea of getting people on and off quick, you know, search and get off. No, this isn't good. Now we got to create our own email. We got to create something for sell. We got to create all these different product groups so that we know where everybody's at and what they're doing at all times, because then people will want to market with us because we can show that people stay on our sites longer.
And thus bore the pivot that ended Google as a search company and became Google as an ad company.
And I think that goes kind of into what we're going to talk about today, because you talk about all of this data, right? And it was a race to figure out how much data I can get, how much data I can collect, how I can monetize it, and what that data is worth. And in the same note, you have people sitting in the dark web saying, hey, look at all this data these people are getting for us. You know, now instead of just, I won't just call it like the standard attack, ransomware attacks were born, right? Because there was data to be had. You could shut down systems and hold a company hostage and open them back up. But now you had another target, and that was all this data-rich environment that you could grab on people. And that data is worth money to them as well. And there's companies that wouldn't want people to know that their data had been breached.
Absolutely. Well, it kind of goes back to our race that we've talked about before, and security being an afterthought, right? That, oh, we got to create all these new things that aggregates data. We'll give you all of these different tools. You get all these games, all these different cool things that you can play with. And then the afterthought is, oh, wait, look at what we just created. We just pulled all this together. We just created a bigger pot of all of this data and everything that now just became a huge, massive target for somebody to go after. I mean, look at the politics going on and all the data that was around voters, history, and all of that, and how many of those companies in the last election got popped.
Well, if you create it and then you start to shine a big, massive light on your capabilities, you're basically turning that light on the data store and saying, come get me. Not saying we shouldn't be using information for what we claim we are, but it definitely, the onus for protecting it is is increased. So if you haven't already figured it out, today we're talking about ransomware, as usual, joined by Eric Willey and Brian Schneebly. I'm Dan Ayala, and we want to talk today just a bit about, you know, the origins of ransomware, how we got there, how the attacks are happening. We'll talk a little bit about victim shaming versus criminal activity, some of the business nature of what about ransomware is. And the ultimate debate is pay the ransom or not pay the ransom. Stay tuned.
That's where we need to cue the music, right there.
That's right.
The ominous tones.
Dun, 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 dun.
Exactly.
But it's more like,
it's such an amazing evolution. If you go back and look at where ransomware was and where it is today. And we were just talking about this, right? That when you started off with ransomware, it was this slow kind of archaic code that encrypts a file, encrypts another file, that was really beholden to the compute on available on the given computer server, whatever the mechanism was. And traditionally it was pretty slow, right? So you could somewhat catch it that, hey, my CPU is sitting at 100%. I can't get to the internet. I can't do anything. Oh yeah. Yeah. Something's being encrypted. Yep. Look at all these files. Yeah. They're flipping. And now you morph into some of the current stories that ransomware is an after effect, right? It's a post data exfiltration tool to then, all right, I put all the money, or I moved all of your data off, and now essentially I'll sell the data back to you. It's crazy. And then you look at playing to the support mechanisms that have come around all of that whole business. It's amazing.
And we're about 7 years into 7 years into ransomware. 2013 was CryptoLocker, and it was that first encrypt by system, put up a message saying you've been taken. Pay me, I think it was like $600 or $300. It was a really low amount of money comparatively now. And you interacted with it directly. It was hit or miss. It sometimes worked. It sometimes didn't. But people wanted to get their files back. And it was really all about just getting money. It was about locking the files and getting the money. This started out in individual devices. Over time, they would start to the bad actors would start to do it across multiple devices, groups of devices, and found new creative, I'll call them incentive models, sales models. You can decrypt half your devices for this amount, or all your devices for this amount. It's like bonus savings on volume discounts if you decrypted with them. And they started to become much more like business enterprises. It was really interesting to watch. You know, you've seen help desks start up. We've seen tech support, interactive chat back and forth with between the affected organizations and the bad actors. Now you've also got insurance companies that are getting in the middle and having those conversations as well. There's PR. Like there's factions that are loud. You know, hackers have always been pretty loud about the things they do, with pride. But now you've got groups that are like, hey, here's this. I've got a dark web feed of all the things we've done, and here's the status of them, and you should look at them. And somewhere along the way, the focus changed as people got more aware of backups, of having good backups and being able to restore. The need to pay the ransom in order to get the backup diminished. And so then we moved into a period now where it's about the backup, it's about the recovery of the files, but it's way more about the prevention of the data from being sent out. And as you mentioned, Eric, it was initially about they've now started doing data exfiltration along with the encryption, and the data exfiltration is the threat of, if you don't pay me X, we'll release this personal information or information about your company to the public. You wouldn't want that to happen now, would you? So it's been a full evolution of business model over the last 7 years into something that you know, moves along with its customer base, or stays one step ahead of its customer base, which is, I wish some businesses would do that.
Right. And I think what gets scary about it is it's almost like the magician's trick, right? And we're starting to see this evolve, that it's, hey, watch what I'm doing over here, because encryption, ransomware encrypting files is very invasive, and typically you pick it up pretty quickly. And I've seen this play out that you've got somebody working on some file. Oh, hey, I can't get to this file anymore. It doesn't work anymore. Yeah, it's got encrypted. Like, it's very real. It's very in your face. You know right away. But I think we're going to start seeing this morph, and it probably already has, that encryption is a way to move attention over to what's going there because it gains eyes really quickly while the real target is somewhere else within the environment. And that becomes really scary on that you've got kind of a fork in the road, a dual pronged breach going on, and how many of enterprises will be able to catch that second prong.
Do you guys know what the first documented and purported example of ransomware was?
I thought it was CryptoLocker in 2013.
1989, the AIDS Trojan. That was also known as PS Cyborg, where you had to send $189 to Panama.
I vaguely remember that. I mean, I kind of remember that.
I bring it up because it was a Harvard-trained biologist, Joe Pop, sent 20,000 infected diskets labeled AIDS information introductory diskets to attendees of the World Health Organization International AIDS Conference. Right? Like, you look at this and you're like, and that was me hitting my microphone, by the way. You look at that and you're like, if you received this from Dr. Pop, and he was this evolutionary biologist, you would plug it into your computer. And after 90 reboots, the Trojan hid directories and encrypted the names of files, et cetera. And you had to send $189 to PC Cyborg Corp, which was a post office box in Panama. And I remember
not to Joe Pop.
No, and I remember hearing this, and that's why I had to go back and look it up, because when we started the conversation just now, and you go back and look at the evolution, this wasn't somebody hiding in a basement. This was a very intelligent person that realized the power of the computer and said, hey, if I found a way to encrypt this, people would want their information back. All doctors would. Anyone doing research would absolutely want it back. And so was born the first example or first documented case of early ransomware.
That is awesome. What year was that?
1989. And they literally call it the AIDS Trojan, right?
And that's awesome.
A little bit of history here.
And I think it's important to put that out there too to people. You go back, so that's 1989 first example, and then since then it's evolved. But it's also evolved, you mentioned insurance as well. You go back 10 years ago, 5 years ago, in cybersecurity or cyber insurance, it just started to roll. It became another product, right, of insurance portfolios. And then all of a sudden, people really started to get hit a lot with ransomware, and they were looking at it. You go back last year in 2019 and talk to any insurance companies, and they tell you that the number one, I won't call it problem. What's that called when they...
Case submission reason?
Case submission, yeah. The number one was cybersecurity, some type of cybersecurity incident. And they were reevaluating how they insure companies, you know, what they were going to be responsible for. Because we all know insurance companies and banks don't necessarily ever lose money.
Well, they did. That's a whole other, that perhaps a whole other episode is around the insurance model and security. But they did for a long time, because the early insurance policies were written rather broadly and rather enticingly, and then they turned into having to pay out. Now you're seeing a lot more complex and a lot more traditional insurance techniques used in those policies. But the early days of cybersecurity insurance, you could get a boatload for not a lot of money and not a lot of exclusions. Many people I know had to use those. I think the insurance company figured it out, the insurance industry figured it out rather quickly that they needed to adjust or they would start losing money.
It is an interesting topic, because I think if you go back to, you know, keeping on the ransomware topic, you know, look at WannaCry, right? I think that played out heavily and brought up the insurance topic, because there was a lot of insurance companies at that time that decided, hey, we're not going to pay out because this is actually an act of war. So it's not included in your policy.
Yeah.
You know, terrorism and acts of war are, right. are too. We've seen some government commentary over the past 6-7 years about the move that these are acts of terrorism. Yeah, definitely a definitely changes the approach on the insurance coverage side.
No, that is really interesting too, because when they would say it was an act of war, they're like, well, you were just fallout, you know, regardless of where you were at in the world and where the attack took place and ended up hitting you over here. Let's say in the middle of Wisconsin, middle of Minnesota, and your business went down. It's like, you're just collateral damage.
It's almost like a force majeure clause.
Yeah.
It's an act of God.
So, and I think for everyone on too, the word ransom, everybody understands ransom, ransomware. It's a form of malware, right? That threatens to publish victims' data, right? Or block access until something is paid out to them. And I think most of our listeners have probably heard the term ransomware. And I think going into 2020, if you haven't, you're seeing it a lot more. There's been a lot of big ransomware attacks, whether it's been on municipalities, whether it's been on state governments. Most recently, people heard about Carnival Cruise, Garmin, both very large enterprises. I think the biggest to date is ISS World, which is in Denmark. And we're talking not just the ransomware, the cost itself to pay the ransom, but the recovery and mitigation costs are over $75 million there. And they're talking that they won't even be restored or have all their systems built back up until maybe the end of 2020. Earlier when we were talking, you brought up Maersk, one of the largest shipping companies in the world, still is having issues from when they got hit, right? And that was over a year ago. So it's definitely real world, but is the motivation target strictly money? Or is it the data, not necessarily for money, but like we're going through COVID research right now and trying to find a vaccine?
Can I beat Dan to it and say, it depends?
We need the button where it goes, it depends, it depends. I agreed.
Yeah, it's every strain is so different with its intent, what it does. It's absolutely staggering. Actually, I think if you look back at ransomware, I think ransomware is actually what put the term Bitcoin probably in the vernacular of a lot of different companies. Because until ransomware came around, I don't know if companies were ever looking at it. I mean, maybe you had some speculative, oh, hey, maybe if we put some money aside in Bitcoin, maybe, you know, that becomes an avenue that we can make a little extra money. But then once ransomware really hit the scene, all of a sudden companies were scrambling. Hey, how do you buy this digital currency thing that is now a thing, right? It became something that you had to have.
Explain Bitcoin for just for the listeners.
Oh, we don't have 5 hours.
And I know we talked about that before, like what is Bitcoin? And then we don't need to totally jump into it. But the reality is too, is if your organization hasn't had a conversation around Bitcoin and
you get it if you needed it.
Yeah.
Yeah. At least know how.
Yeah.
And
nutshell, it's a digital currency. It has a lot of, it has underpinning technology and something called blockchain, which you're seeing in a lot of other things. But it is based on the ability to have transactions that are both distributed and vetted, and very public, yet still masked in some level of privacy. So there's this that you can see the money move, every money movement. It's like the Venmo when they publish all the tos and froms, right? But the tos and froms are anonymous.
And if you get bored trading stocks, you could start trading Bitcoin. And I got very good at buying high and selling low. It's a great way to lose money.
Hey, I have that trait too on Coinbase.
So. Now going back to it, you know, to the public side of it. So they understand ransomware. They've heard of Bitcoin, regardless if they bought it ever. Maybe somebody told them, hey, go invest in company X, Y, or Z because they trade in Bitcoin and it's flying up high, right? And then they did, but had no idea when to sell it. And then it came crashing right back down. it's a form of currency being used, and that's what some of these threat actors are using. But now,
although they're preferring Monero now, they're moving to Monero. But yeah, Bitcoin is still very prevalent.
So if the goal is strictly to get into an enterprise or a municipality or an organization, encrypt data, encrypt information, and sometimes it's not even just encrypting data. Sometimes it's, can we find a way to shut down a production system? If you're a large manufacturer and we're able to shut you down in order to get you back up, you know, you look at some of the largest manufacturers, let's say you're a large automotive manufacturer. Your supply base, if they ever shut you down, you're on the hook that for each hour that we're down, you pay X, right? It's a very large sum of money. Mm-hmm. And all the malicious actors know this as well. So the longer you're down, the more money you're losing. So they know that it's in your best interest to pay. It's a pretty easy formula you put together, because if you're only asking for a marginal percentage of what their cost impact is going to be, I mean, you could sit in the boardroom and say, why would we just not pay this?
Right.
You know, we stand to lose X. And if we just pay 10% of it, we're back up and going. You know, let's get back up and going.
If the pure motivation of the attack and the pure scope of the attack is only around making the data unavailable.
Right.
That calculus works fine if you're thinking about just recovering and getting going again. Doesn't, however, take into account any of the trust that are there still things left in the system. So you still have a whole recovery cost beyond that. Has nothing to do with if the data actually left the organization and you have now an exposure that you have to deal with. So I'll argue that calculus likely doesn't work nearly as often as it used to. Because now you have to deal with data breach laws, timing to get those out. The cost of if I'm down for an hour, it's $100 million lost. And this wants to charge me $1 million. It's 1%. Call it a rounding error. We pay it out and we get our lines going again. All numbers, by the way, are fictional and made up, which is the definition of fictional. So you get back up and going, but how long can you trust your systems? Do you trust your systems to even run at that point because somebody was in there tampering around them? Back to the misdirection question. I think that taking that very principled approach of I can get back up and going leaves too much out of the decision process, out of the consideration. And I'd argue doing that route is actually more dangerous than taking a little more time down and looking broader at the problem.
I would agree. And to add on, there's two other elements after it. Number one, if you do decide to pay, will they actually give you the keys to decrypt the data? Now, I think the vast majority of stories where we've heard people paying, it's had a positive end result, but there are some underlying stories where people have paid and the keys never come back. And the second one is there is a high percentage, and I don't know the statistics offhand, I'd have to pull them up, of companies that once they pay, they get hit again later. Because now somebody already knows how to get into the system. They're just going to come back around. Hey, that becomes easy money. I'm going to hit them again.
Oh, absolutely. What else did I leave behind? I left a rat behind that lets me back in. Or I've got data, and I said I've destroyed it. But I decided I'm using it for my own purposes. I've run out of money. Let's hit you again.
So we have to define a term that Dan just used, a rat. And it's similar to the actual rat you would think of in your house that you definitely don't want in your house, but it's a remote access Trojan. So it's essentially another piece of beautiful malware that allows a hook in a system for somebody to get back in later. They are dirty little tools. And there are some highly sophisticated ones there that are very, very tough to catch.
Some might know them as backdoors.
Yep.
But if you just got hit and you were ransomed, wouldn't you spend the time to go through all this? And I bring this up because I feel like when you get hit and you're very public and it's in the public eye, this is when people get let go. This is when people point the finger. I can think of real case scenarios where the threat actor came through and got admin credentials through somebody who had actually already been let go. And the first thing they did was spend the first 48 hours trying to figure out if this was an insider threat, that this was, you know, an employee that's upset with us, only to realize it had nothing to do with that. It was kind of like the misdirection, right? Mm-hmm. But then, of course, then all the blame started to go right back to the head of security.
Well, I think the blame one, let me put the blame one on ice for a second, because I think that's a whole other topic. But I want to peel apart the where do you go when it happens? What's the first thing you do? The first thing you have to think about, and this is before anything ever happens, is have really firm discussions within your organization about what is your operational intent. Is it to resume service? Is it to ferret out the security issue? Because those two are counter to each other. Or is it someplace along the middle? Like, we'll give ourselves 24 hours to investigate, and then we have to get to service resumption. And those are the kind of things that you don't want to be having those discussions for the first time when the incident has already happened. The more you talk about those in advance, the more you get them as part of your business, as your part of your incident response plan, and everybody knows it. You say, hey, we've got a plan. We're going to take 24 hours. We're going to pull the plugs. We're going to look at everything. And we're going to tell the public, pound sand, we're investigating. It is our due care to do so. But you have that in your mind, and you're not debating it when it happens. But I think there is a necessity to take some time to understand, because as I said before, if you just get straight to service resumption, you'll likely overlook either some other thing that's going on, that either involved directly or indirectly. You will leave the thing open for them to just come right back and do it again. Or you will be running on flawed process. Anytime I think of manufacturing, I spent years in pharma, and GXP, good manufacturing procedures, and other things. It's very similar to ISO 9001 quality processes. And the last thing you want is to be running processes that might have a defect in the process that you might not know about. Now that defect translates all the way through. So I think if you're trading money, let's say you're doing your trades and it's all microtransactions, it's all very small. Maybe you have a high output, high downtime cost. Maybe you have a little different approach to those. But if you're doing things that are more formulaic, systematic, involve patient safety, involve user safety, that's a different story. So as always, it depends.
Yes, there it is. Yeah, saying that you've got everything cleaned up, that everything is back in order, that everybody's out of the house. I think oftentimes in headlines, it's sold as, well, that's pretty easy to do. You know, you just run some tools, an investigation firm comes out and says, all right, green light, everything's good. And that's not the case. I mean, I'm not going to name any names, but there was a rather big forensics firm that I believe came under fire this year with some lawsuits because they gave the green light and it wasn't all remediated. There was another breach going on while they were in the systems trying to forensically go through everything. That's a tough game.
Is there ever such a thing as a green light when it comes to security topics?
Absolutely not.
The green light is when it's turned off in the closet, locked,
and
disconnected with no data on it.
It's the same thing. Every board presentation we do, we open up with never say never. I can never say we won't be breached. It is it's almost a zero sum game. It's a tough game we're playing of cat and mouse a lot of times. And there is always somebody out there with more time, more money, and a higher technical capability that, let's be honest, if they really want to get in, they are going to get in. So what we do is we get better on, Dan, going back to the processes and everything, that we get better on detecting early on and trying to stop and contain.
Two things I wanted to say there too, because when you guys were talking about a forensics firm, when you talk about IR, incident response, there's a lot of security companies out there that don't do IR specifically because of the risk involved to go in and help remediate and clean up organizations' environment. And like you said, give a green light and something bad happens again, right? You didn't have it cleaned up all the way. There's another thing when you talked about training. in that these conversations, you should have already had this conversation internally, probably more than once, so that you've asked some tough questions to each other, and somebody in management in a different position gets to sit there on the hot seat and sweat a little bit to decide what's the right, is there a right answer to this, right? And you guys talk through it. There was a game called Backdoors and Breaches by Black Hills Security, and I loved it. I bought up like 40 of them before anyone get their hands on. I read through it all. You know, I was using them almost as gifts, right? And for anybody listening right now, you know who you are that got one, you know, because if I ran into you, I was like, oh, look at this. I got it in my bag, right? Or I had one in my suit coat. And they're really, really cool. But now let's go into today.
So now all I picture is Brian walking around with a suit coat. He's like the watch salesman out on the street with all these different games just inside. That's phenomenal.
Backdoors, breaches. Get your backdoors and breaches. First 40 customers. Dan, I can't hear you there.
Sorry. Highly recommend the game. Facilitates some amazing tabletop exercises. I'll put the link in the show notes.
But now what do you do though? Now that we're all work from home, is there, because it's a tabletop game, right? And for those that are listening, and it's a way that you can play both offensively and defensively on both sides of the table. You can invite people from your organization to sit in that maybe aren't part of the security team, but now get to be part of the listening, the back and forth, and some of the decision-making, which is important. It goes right back to what Dan was saying. These conversations need to be had before it happens. But now that we're working from home, and maybe Eric, I'll throw this one to you. How do you facilitate those type of, where you were previously doing a tabletop exercise, but now you're working remotely? Or Dan, maybe you have an example of that, where you're keeping those conversations abreast, you're working together, you're playing through some exercises.
At the end of the day, at least from my viewpoint, and Dan, I mean, obviously I'd be interested in your view, but I think a tabletop is a game of what ifs. What if this, then what's our move, right? So from a work from a home standpoint, it's, okay, what if remote said worker in this department gets hit? Now what? Where can they go? What can they do? The same thing, we played this. I mean, as you look back past some of the stories where backups have been encrypted, and then you hear about the ransomware is actually timed to in some of the backups that once you purge out, you age them out, I don't know, 60, 90 days, whatever it is, that it comes back again. It's really intriguing stuff. What happens if we see that, right? And it's a game of, can we recover? And the answer, you don't always have an answer for everything, right? Because there's infinite number of past things that could happen, but you play, it's the actuarial game, right? It's the what is the percentage of likelihood that something is going to happen? And then we'll play the what if game on that. And do we have a good answer for those? And it morphs, right? With the whole work from home thing, that we changed the dialogue to some new scenarios that we hadn't contemplated before, that now we have a large populace that is at home and connecting. What if their home computer gets popped on their home network and tries to jump laterally into ours? Well, and then you kind of back it out and you go, well, all right, that's kind of a similar conversation we've had before on going to Starbucks, being at a hotel, and some of those scenarios on a malicious machine sitting right next to yours, trying to get back into your network. So it's a game. It comes back to, so I've got a couple of presentations that I've done on security has no finish line, tying it back to the whole racing theme. And that's exactly it, right? That if you see security is a check the box, here's my compliance, I'm now done, you lost. That's not how it works. It's continual evolution. It's the, what's the Kaizen, right? You're continually getting better, and it's that whole approach, and you can never stop. It's like, it's snowboarding, right? Snowboarding, you always have to be on the edge of your snowboard. If you ride flat, you fall, you get chatter, and it doesn't work. You've got to keep going back and forth and making sure that you are continually getting better and evaluating what you've done. And once you get done with creating your controls, you're circling back. All right, now that I've created everything, do those controls still work? Are they still effective? Can I actually track them? And it's a never-ending story, which was a good movie, by the way.
Continuous improvement,
exactly. There's another term there called Genchi Gumbutsu, and it basically means go and see, learn, and apply, right? So like, if you heard a manager say that, he meant like, yeah, you could be in the sales role, but I want you to go out on the manufacturing floor. I want you to go see the process, see where it actually failed, and then figure out how so-and-so improved it. You know, go check in what they did and how they made it work. And I think you guys talk about that a lot. When you say, well, how do you vet certain products, et cetera? Well, a lot of times you'll go talk to your other peers to ask, have you used this? That's kind of a form of Genshin Kimbutsu. One thing I want to turn back onto since we were talking here about the ransomware is, if you had a scenario similar to somebody that's been in the news, let's say it was Carnival, let's say it was Garmin, do you A, pay the ransom, and then B, why? And Dan, I know you're going to say, well, it depends, which...
There are no, how about this? A number of factors will go into your calculation, and each organization will have to decide for itself what makes the most sense. But I think there's a number of things to think about. You know, first of all, do you have backups? Can you recover the data at all? If you can't recover the data at all, then you're going to be more prone to asking. And if it's critical to the operation of your business, you should start thinking about how you'll fix this for next time. But two, you may have to pay in order to recover that data. It may be the only way.
Well, instead of saying it that way, and this goes to more of the consumer-based listeners that we have rather than just the security-based, but why wouldn't you pay? Meaning, I've talked to people that were like, well, Brian, if people just stop paying ransomware or stop paying, then there wouldn't be ransomware out there. And I'm like, I think that's a misunderstanding of the true targets sometimes of ransomware. Just like we were talking, you know, dangle over here, steal from over here. I mean, you could be going in to try to take research, for example. Look at what's going on with COVID. You could be going in literally trying to take some of the research around vaccination, immunization, et cetera. And all along, you're putting this ransom up there with the intentions that, I don't really care if you pay. Once I have this type of data, right, I'm not giving it back to you.
Right. But Brian, we can't pay. We don't negotiate with digital terrorists.
Exactly. That's the next step to that.
before we go on to the ethical componentries and some legal componentries, I want to dive into what Brian was saying is just there are different motives at play, and so you have to look at not just your motive. Well, actually, no, I don't think you need to look at the motive of the threat actor. I think you need to look at the motive of your organization.
Oftentimes you won't know what the motive of the threat actor
is. Right, but even if you do, even if they're saying, we're going to release this if you don't pay, and you say, well, I don't even have any backups, or I can't recover my business unless I pay, you may have to pay into it in order to keep things going, even though that's not the end game of the threat actor.
Right. And so going back to the conversation, Dan, you were talking about make sure you have backups and all of that. I think you've got to go back further and have a fundamental understanding of what you have and what yes. matters. You've got to start there. That if you've got a whole vault of Word documents that have no meaning, no intrinsic value to your business, and they get encrypted, who cares? Let it go. Doesn't matter. But now go ahead, Brian.
So I was going to say, you make a great point, though. And I think people from a business mindset, you're going to start to see people inventory and find a way to categorically inventory everything they have in real time. There's a business out there just to do that. So when this type of stuff happens, this goes back to some of the manufacturers when they were having a warranty issue. It's like, well, this could arc and this then could blow up and then combustion happens and boom, next thing we know, an engine's blowing up. But the chance of that happening is 1 in 10 million. We'll take our risk.
Right.
Right. And you have all this data. And it's like, if you look at all the data we have, as soon as something happens, yep, we already know all this data set, not worried about it. Oh, they got their hands on the big cookie jar. That's a problem. How fast can we get up to production? Okay. Right. So we can minimize our losses there from the data side. If we pay this out to get the data back, is there a chance they could just release the data anyways?
And it also helps get you in an emotional state to make better decisions when it does happen, because you've already played through this in your head. And if you haven't already gone through the scenarios, if you already haven't played this through, when it does happen, and let's be honest, very likely it will happen in some capacity and some volume, you will be better prepared to make decisions and respond to it. You know, as I look at a lot of companies that responded in the COVID, you know, everybody working from home, a lot of IT departments went, oh crap, what do we do? What do we do? And it was this whole emotional thing and everybody got, oh, we have to meet it with an IT response, an IT response. Well, no, actually, if you stop, let's breathe for a second. It's a business continuity conversation. It's a people discussion. We'll help from a technology standpoint. We can help facilitate different things, but you have to keep the emotion in check so that you're making sound decisions. And I think, and Dan backed me up on this, I think statistically the studies have shown the companies that have already gone through and played out those scenarios end up paying a lot less in the long run for the response and end up being seen in a much better light from the public because they already knew how they were going to respond. They knew what they were going to do.
Yeah, so much of incident response is now, we moved many years ago from defend to respond. You will be judged based on the response. Your organization will be judged on the response, both communications, both technology, even more so on communications and transparency. But the more you've got that in hand, the better off the response will be, even if the answer still is we had to pay a ransom and we had to, and your data has been put into a state of flux. The being clear about it and having an approach before you go in makes that a lot easier to be ready for. Doesn't make the messaging any easier, but it certainly makes the way people perceive it as much more put together, much more cohesive, and therefore much more confidence that the organization is going to do the right things to both prevent another one and to remedy this one.
So Dan, just for the audience as well, if you pay a ransomware, right? Because let's say they encrypted your data and you want to make sure they unencrypt the data. They still had their hands on that data. Take, for example, Uber. They paid a ransomware, but they never reported the breach. They did everything they could to try to keep that from being in the public spotlight. And the reality is now they paid X amount in fines. I think it was over $100 million in fines, right? You have the head of security possibly going to jail.
Yeah, personal criminal charges are now part of the mix.
Yeah, and this was, and I can only speculate on what the organization was thinking or what one individual or a group of individuals was thinking, but you're in this position where it's, hey, if we pay this ransomware, it goes away, and we're right in the middle of an investigation, we can do X, Y, and Z, and we don't have to report this. Now, tell the audience, why do you have to report that?
It's the law.
And why is it the law? Why is it the law to report that?
Well, I think let's talk about where it's the law first.
Okay.
So there is no, if you're in Europe, there are very standard laws in Europe and in many countries around the world around the time in which you have to report from the time you detect it until the time you start to tell people that their data was potentially affected. In Europe, that's 72 hours. And that law is becoming the gold standard for establishing response programs. In the US, I think there are 52. Yes, 52. We have some territories that have their own laws around data breach response. They are all materially different and they all have different reporting requirements. But at the end of it, all of them have something that says you got to let the person know that their personal data, and they each define personal data slightly differently, their personal data was put at risk. So it's the law. And the beauty of the European model is you have one set of rules. The beauty of the American model is you have 52 different jurisdictions that could all come at you slightly differently if you don't.
And to add on to it, for a public company as well, you
have
constituents. Yeah. You have stockholders that you are beholden to. Now, granted, with the business roundtable, we can get into the changing ideals there. But these are disclosable events that could impact the financial ability, stability of your company.
Yeah, it's still required as a 10K item.
Yeah.
Yeah. If you're a publicly traded company, there's some other, I think, I won't say I think, there are some other issues there too when it comes to reporting when something like that happens. So backing up, that was a good explanation of why. Okay, why you have to report that. So why would a company not want to report it then, if it's the law? Like,
well, there are those companies, there are those organizations that do not believe the law applies to them. That's just a general, there's always going to be that kind of people. There are those that believe that it may not fit the level, through their own interpretation or their own legal advice, may not think it fits the definition of what needs to be disclosed. That one's a more innocent mistake. And you might be able to defend it and say, here is our discussion around it. We consciously made this risk decision and we think this is it. And then there are those that think the material risk to the business is greater than the penalties of not disclosing. You come back to some organizations. When Sarbanes-Oxley came out, I was having a discussion with somebody I did not work with, but somebody that was asking me, hey, what are the fines involved in this? And we started talking about it. And this person then said, well, I think it actually cost me less to not comply and take the fines than it would be to comply. And that goes into people's business calculations as well. And then fourth is there are businesses that really don't have a regard for their customers, or they're disintermediated from their customers. If you look at B2B businesses, I'm not putting down B2B businesses, but there are B2B businesses where the business knows the business they work with, but doesn't have quite the sensitivity for the downstream ultimate end user, the person who is affected by it all the way down. And so it might be a little more clouded as they're making that decision about the impact. So think about the B2B relationship, but not the ultimate consumer at the end of it all.
So if you're a publicly traded company in...
Or they just want to hide it.
Yeah. Okay. But if you're a publicly traded company and something like this gets out into the news, I mean, typically you see a stock price go down. So I look at, in the case of Uber, and this is probably going to create an SHIT storm of
poop storm.
People saying a poop storm. But if your lofty valuation is valued on the fact that you've still never once shown a profit, you have this go-to-market plan, but you're still, your path to profitability really still isn't fundamentally there. And all of a sudden something like this happens and then happens again, we're at risk of watching that price just go all the way down. Mm-hmm. We can't have that happen. We need that cash influx. We need that money, right?
Right.
So to report this, no way. We can't report this. Not now. We just had something happen that was public and everybody knew about it. We can't do it.
I think this falls into the category of two of kind of what Dan was saying on the interesting rationalization on, well, the law doesn't really apply to me, because I believe this one, correct me if I'm wrong here, the way this played out is they claim they were paying a bug bounty. Well, if it's a bug bounty because you just found something, well, then technically it's not a breach. It's not disclosable. We can fix it and move on. But then I think after the fact, what was it, like 57 million records, something like that? I mean, it was fairly massive.
So for the listeners out there, so some of these malwares that are out there, you have Wasted Locker, you have Ragnar Locker. These are names of ransomware or groups, right? And Ragnar Locker actually says, when you were talking about bug bounty, says here will be permanent list of companies who would like to keep in secret the info leakage, exposing themselves and their customers, partners to even greater risk than a bug hunting award. Their point there is, if you pay us, you're paying a bug hunting reward because we found this vulnerability, a vulnerability being a way in, etc. And they're calling it a bug bounty reward. Or else if you don't pay, you go on their wall of shame so that people can see all the info that they were able to leak on you.
Right. And to explain bug bounty, a lot of companies have bug bounty programs. And essentially what they are is they partner up with different companies and say, hey, you freelance security researchers, software developers, whomever, you can continually poke at our systems. And when you find something, you're going to go through this channel and disclose it to us. And by disclosing it to us, we will give you some sum of money back. So it's kind of crowdsourcing security, because I mean, let's be honest, it becomes expensive. It becomes very hard to retain good people to find all of the vulnerabilities in software. Software is highly complex, the bigger a company is. So you rely on crowdsourcing and pay people out to ethically disclose to you the flaws that they find.
Yeah, and then to what extent do you say this was, they got in, did they do it? Is it any different than a data exfiltration by a bad actor? Do you have to bring intentionality into the discussion? What was the intention? There's definitely both sides to this particular one. Although I think the nature in which it was handled, the lack of transparency, the lack of clarity around it, it makes it a much more difficult thing to be able to defend. We were just following a bug bounty process, but we'll have to let the court see what happened.
And that's where I was going to go next with this. Do you think also that with this being very public facing now in the news, in the courts, charges being pressed, that whatever is decided here kind of sets a precedent for people in future roles? You know, if an organization says, well, we're not going to pay, or we are going to pay, but we don't want to disclose this. You know, that security person, is he, what's the word I'm looking for? A whistleblower? Then if he goes and does report it, right? There's some laws here that are, like you said, are being broken. And I think, you know, in due time, we'll see what ends up happening here. But I think because there's a very public facing judicial process that's going to play out, there will be kind of a line drawn in the sand and kind of a first step approach of, hey, here's the type of responsibility that we're going to hold organizations to now moving forward.
Right. That's actually an interesting topic in and of itself. Not only the case law that's going to be generated, but the overarching kind of federal response to a lot of the things that comes back. I mean, there were talks at one point for making CISOs personally liable for breaches and stuff like that. Now, luckily, I think that's gone by the wayside, and let's hope that doesn't come back. But it's very interesting to see how the case law comes back. I did want to add, for those companies that do get hit with ransomware, if you don't have a retainer with the firm, one of the best places to check first to see if you can decrypt your files, nomoreransom.org. And I don't think they're the only organization. I think there's a couple out there that have come up with decryption keys for a lot of the major strains out there, and they will help out. There's a lot of, you know, as we've talked about the security community wanting to give back, there's a lot of that in the ransomware specific area on people giving back their time, trying to help you get back up and running.
And since you said that as well, if you don't have a retainer, first thing you should call if you do get ransomware, first thing you should call is your cybersecurity insurance company. They may have contacts or relationships or some set pricing with DFIR firms or with legal counsel to help you along the way. This is especially important for small medium businesses that may not have in-house counsel, or this may not be an technology and data breach law may not be a specialty in-house. But also be aware that get cybersecurity insurance, get something. It may not do all, it is not quite like when your windshield gets cracked and you say, here's $100, go fix it, and it just magically comes back repaired and that's all you're out. They may have limitations in coverage. They may have, they can help you with certain things. The incident response teams would then be working for the insurance companies in many cases. So you're going to want to take and understand the nature of the relationship and what you're seeing back. Get the insurance, have it. You got to have something there. Plus more and more compliance requirements are saying, do you have cybersecurity insurance? Yes or no. So if you don't have it, go look into it, talk to your general insurance, your E&O carrier, and see what you can put together. Excuse me. So that's it on insurance. But the one thing I want to turn this to now is, so we talked about the CISO at Uber, and we've talked about some of the, some of the charges brought there. But at the same time, there is a habit in in security incidents of victim shaming, of blaming the company, the organization that was attacked, and losing sight of the fact that this was a criminal attack. This was some bad actor that broke in. And yes, we can say, yes, you should have locked it. You know, when somebody breaks into your house because you left the door unlocked, you should have locked your door. Okay, fine, good. But the person that we go after is not the homeowner. It's the person who broke in. And that's where we put our ire and our anger and our focus on defending against.
Some people will say, though, is it called breaking in, though, if the front door was unlocked?
Yes, if you it's illegal entry. It's still B and E.
Now that I would agree with. Well, let's say maybe you're at your cottage right now and you don't even close the door. You just had the screen. And I mean, you're just, everybody's sleeping, right? I go back. The reason
criminal
I bring this up is
trespassing then.
Yeah. I bring this up because people say it all the time. Well, you left the door wide open, or you still invaded, you call it invading someone's privacy, breaking and entering, whatever you want to call it. You still broke into someone's system and tried to do something really, really bad.
It's not as though the threat actor tripped, right, fell, and landed in an SSH key that got them into your network. there was intentionality.
This actually gets into the whole idea, and this could be a whole nother section as well, on the testing of security software and where it plays in this line. Because as you get into the CFAA, right, the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, that was what, back in 86?
Yeah, I think so. It's long in the tooth. 86, yeah.
Yeah. Woo, that was one. Wow. This is going back. So looking back at that, I believe it the way it defines kind of or what it's all predicated on is just purely unauthorized access to a computer system. Mm-hmm. And if that's the case, then in the case of the SSH key, if you tried to brute force it and had a successful connection, you are in violation of this act.
So then let's pivot back. When we talked about victim shaming, who's responsible? Does the entire organization accept responsibility and move on their way? Do you find a scapegoat? And because you're a very public-facing company, we need to show that we made swift action. Everything's been taken care of. We've removed our security leader, or, you know, five people were fired from Sun facility because they were completely inept. And this is what occurred. Where do you go from there? And
it depends.
But let's back up too. If you're taking a role, okay, moving into that position. And for those listening that haven't attended one of our previous sessions, CISO, Chief Information Security Officer, if you're in that role, do you make sure with the organization that you kind of set a line in the sand to show what our risk appetite is, right? And I know that's a whole nother conversation, but again, you're a very public-facing company. You're Uber, right? Now somebody is possibly going to prison. You're Carnival Cruise, your Garmin, you're one of these large corporations. Where do you go from here?
I think
this would be an interesting topic to get a lawyer on, actually, at some point. I'd be interested to talk through some of this, because you get into the element of commercially reasonable care and all of the different verbiage that you use in contracts and you see play out in the legal realm. What equates to you did this amount, you did just enough
do
to
care.
Try to prevent it. Do care, right?
But I think it to joke on, it depends. It does, because there's negligence, and negligence in any role is not tolerated. If I take something, I ignore it and I proceed anyway. That is that would be grounds, even in light of not focusing on the victim. There's only so much, there are certain steps you do need to take, either by law or by your own organizational principles and policies. And if you're not following those, the remediation for that is potentially up to and including termination usually. So do that. But I think the stance in organizations has changed. over the years. I'd go back 5 years, and the answer was, we had a breach, we fired the CISO, let's move on. And that's the public announcement. I think that this has become, the one upside to this becoming more commonplace is that, one, everybody can't be firing their security leader every 6 weeks when one of these happens, because they happen a lot. There's lots of little things that come into the organization. And they're happening all around. And two, if you said people who were not who are not field tested in incidents are no longer hireable, you'd lose an entire population of people of good security leaders for your organization. So I'm really glad to see that the trend, a little selfishly, because I am a CISO, a little selfishly, is that the trend is moving toward we had an incident. Our security team was heavily involved. We worked with law enforcement. We responded transparently, quickly, and we have been honest and disclosed all the things that are going on. And we've looked at our own procedures and enhanced them. And I'd argue we have a better security team as a result of it, because we learned, we adjusted. It's almost agile. We failed. We had an issue. We learned from it. We've come back stronger. Now, if it becomes continuous, if you constantly are having incidents or repeating the same problems over and over, then it becomes a different story. But I think the fact that organizations are looking at road testing, road worn security leaders with large incident response as a badge of honor, as a badge of experience, maybe not of honor, a badge of experience. I think that's very positive. And you're actually seeing heavy recruitment of CISOs with this experience to come to organizations that have either come out of one of those and need somebody who can help them respond through the incident, or are being proactive and want to have somebody in there that can be ready when the time comes and help them through an incident. Maybe they're in a high risk field, maybe they're in a high visibility area, or they have a security program they want to build up around and use that person's experience to do so. So I think this is changing for the better.
With a key element of what you said, in the absence of negligence.
Of course, negligence wins the day or loses the day in every case. You didn't do the work, you hide it, you consciously said, we should be doing this, but we're going to do this. And not because you are balancing risk in the organization, you just said, whatever. That's a different story altogether. That negligence is never permissible.
And I agree that I think the battle-tested CISO is staying now. And that's good, because I don't think anybody wants to see a game of CISO musical chairs. That doesn't work well for anybody. That you want to have somebody that's got a vested interest, that it's not, again, back to the zero-sum game, that is, it's as soon as something happens, I'm out the door, right? Somebody that knows what they're doing can continually build it. And again, come back to never say never. There will always be some event. Something will happen. It's unavoidable. We're going to get there.
But when the event is ransomware, though, and I find that now that ransomware is back in the headlines, organizations are freaking out again. It's 5-6 months ago, it wasn't just the conversation of, our firewalls are kind of, our perimeter is coming down because everybody's working from home, et cetera. What do we have to worry about? The second it became ransomware again, organizations, I find, tend to panic more or freak out more when the word ransomware is used.
Why do you think that is?
So for one, when a dollar amount's put out there, and they're going to be held responsible, or I won't say responsible, if they're going to be held to having to pay a dollar amount and they didn't have the budget to begin with, now you have to go to the board and ask that question.
So the $3.86 million that floats around every year and varies of the cost of a breach was too amorphous for most organizations to say this applies to me, but when they actually have to pay out the cash.
Yeah. And I'm not saying, so I gotta be careful in how I say this. You look at a bunch of tools, right, that you could put in the number of people I need. I'm not saying every organization needs an error.
Why did you look at me when you said that?
Me? I was looking.
Oh, you said look at a bunch of tools. No, I'm sorry.
it, not every organization needs, you know, a group of Navy SEALs, Marines, an aircraft carrier, and a bunch of attack helicopters in terms of the tools they need, because they could be a small organization. Some organizations are big and maybe need, but my point is every organization needs at least some tools and some people, right? Handing somebody a butter knife and saying, go to battle, because this is war, doesn't work, okay? That's going to be a loss, right? So A, you need people, you need people trained. And we have a whole nother topic of debate and discussion around who those people are. Do you get people with degrees? Do you get people with certs, et cetera? And we can talk about that later. But you also need certain tools, right? Not just a butter knife and a stick of butter. You do need an aircraft carrier occasionally. I do need actual ships that have missiles, right? I need some things to actually defend and try to protect this. But when an organization says, and there's a lot of them right now in the state of Michigan, sorry, our budgets are cut 20%. There is a downturn, right? And some people say we're not in a downturn. Well, from a production side, production is down. So we're cutting. 20% gone. I've seen an organization that cut 50% of its IT staff, right? Then something like this happens. You get hit with ransomware. You got to go to the board. They have to pay money. They come back and say, what? Why weren't an IR company, an incident response company, comes in, puts all these tools in place, and then says to the organization when they're done, hey, we can leave these tools in place, but it's going to cost X, Y, and Z, even outside of what you're paying ransomwise. And this is where companies, and I'm not referring to my own, I work for a vendor, but this is where they come in and now they're pricing the tool where you could have bought it at A, you're now buying it at D, right? Because they know you're vulnerable. You're in that risk position. So why do organizations freak out about ransomware? It's an unbudgeted amount of money that nobody in the organization was prepared to pay unless they were having a preemptive discussion to say, hey, we're going to allocate this money to the side. But during a time when production's down and you're allocating, let's say, $5 million over here, and everyone's saying, hey, our budgets are tight. Why do we still have this money sitting over here? Let's just pull that money aside. Then something bad happens.
And I think that goes for breaches in general. Not necessarily, it doesn't have to necessarily be ransomware that causes downtime. There can be other elements. I mean, heck, internal IT teams can cause extended outages for a bad code push or a bad update or something along those lines. But again, back to your point, and I agree, the conversation has to be had and numbers generated on what would it cost for X number of hours of downtime, because let's be honest, it will likely happen.
It will happen. It is a matter of when, not if. And if you prepare your response accordingly for that, then you avoid the discussions that Brian just had where we weren't prepared, we weren't. And as part of your planning, you put aside some reserves for things like this so that they aren't, when they do happen, because they will happen when they do happen, that you're not caught completely flat-footed.
And this also goes to the purchasing groups as well, because purchasing groups in organizations are involved in helping set up budgets, et cetera. And I can remember discussions on the automotive side hearing Steve Kiefer talk at one of the SAE events. And this was 3 or 4 years ago. And he said, working with, as a purchasing organization, we were a very large company. We were very used to pushing our terms of service out there, our contracts, and people signed them. He goes, what we found dealing with the West Coast tech companies is, you can send that paperwork over, they send it right back to you and say, no, here's ours. You're going to sign ours. Right. And there's this kind of this, I won't call it, it's an East Coast, West Coast, it's a tech, it's a this, but from the tech side, and even the people I've talked with in the industry, maybe, yeah, you sell into every vertical, but you don't understand the difficulties that every vertical has when it comes to downturn or budgets, right. And how those companies and their purchasing groups work. And automotive and aeronautical groups have some of the largest purchasing groups in the world, right? They deal with some of the biggest budgets because of the number of components they buy. And now when you throw IT in there and they come in and they're like, could you imagine an automotive company saying to a software company, I want 3% reduction per year, right? And that conversation
not happening.
Has just recently been had. And in my own organization, and I threw it out there and they said, Brian, every year we're improving. I'm like, right. But if you were to say that to the largest automotive manufacturers, they'd say, okay, prove it. Show me where. Show me all right. the lines of code. Because what you're technically saying is, I did all these engineering changes to improve. We didn't ask you to do those engineering changes. You did them on your own. Yeah, but we have to do that in order to protect you. Why? Right? Like that's a purchasing mentality. Why? Naze. Ask why five times, get to the root cause, and give me a 3% reduction every year for the next 5 years.
Brutal.
Right? And I said that internally to all the guys and all the management, and they were like, Brian, that doesn't make any sense. I'm like, I didn't say it does make sense. I'm saying you got to find a way to be able to explain that. And they're like, that doesn't work anywhere in the world. I'm like, I understand that, but every mindset's different in each vertical, right? And it also depends on who you're working with. And when budgets are tight and purchasing groups are lock and key, again, ransomware being top of mind right now, and all of a sudden people are really taking it. I won't say everyone's taking it serious. They're hearing about it. They're having the discussions again. Are we vulnerable to ransomware? And does this, can I ask a question? Do consumers have to worry about ransomware? Because I know recently we published a free decryptor for Mac, and trying to remember what it was. This had to do with my organization. For EvilQuest, rolled out some ransomware, and we were able to do a public facing decryptor that you could take off of Facebook or LinkedIn. But why would and I know we're kind of getting at the top of the hour here, but why would a consumer have to worry about it?
I think a consumer has to worry about it as much as a small or medium business, because oftentimes people come back to backups. Consumers aren't doing good backing up of their information. They're assuming that the cloud services they use, that the redundancy that's there is the same as backing up, and it's not. If data gets corrupted, the corrupted data gets synced up to those cloud services, especially if you're using the free versions of them. Things like Dropbox. If you're a paid Dropbox subscriber, you can roll back 30 days and 60 days. I think it's at least 30 days of changes to files, and you can do them in mass. It's really quite a good defense. People are not adhering to some of the 3-2-1 backup strategies for their own personal life, where you keep 3 copies, 2 of which are on site and 1 of which is in the, 2 of which are physical, 1 of which is off site and 1 of which is cloud based. That's a lot for a person to have to remember to do, and so most people aren't doing it. The other is there's also a lot of scams where they may or may not. We've already seen people getting consumers getting affected by your calls purporting to be from Microsoft. And other organizations saying, we've detected that your machine has been infected. Please send us $225 and we'll help you clean it up. And then they install a rat and they end and do more damage that they can then help clean up for the fee. So, I mean, the consumers are always a target. People are a target. But the ransomware industry as a whole has shifted toward a much more lucrative place, which is 6, large 6 and 7 and even 8 digit numbers to take an organization which has much greater buying power or spending power and hit once there and affect a very large paycheck.
Yeah, and then to build on that, and I was going to actually take the counter to kind of to Dan's. I think the consumer has to be concerned with it, but not overly concerned with it. I don't think that's the number one thing that they have to worry about in their home life. There are much bigger privacy issues and all of that. And back to Dan's point, reason being that organized cybercrime is run like a business, and a business looks at return on time. And where am I going to get the biggest bang for my time? And that is organizations. So I'm going to target organizations that have deep pockets, that have meaningful data that they don't want to have exfiltrated, they don't want locked up, and they will pay. The average consumer, you might get residual targets, but by and large, your average consumer, I don't think is directly being targeted by the organized cybercrime using ransomware.
It's too labor intensive. I can go to 10 organizations, get $80 million or $50 million or $20 million in ransom, or I'd have to do at $300 a pop that's, you know, ridiculous number of individuals I'd have to find.
Right. I don't think they want to invest the time going back and forth with my grandma trying to explain what they just did and encrypting her data and having to explain it to her why she should pay.
Well, maybe it means I have to explain a little less about iTunes.
So it's funny you say that, and just to bring it full circle. So in 1989, the Age Trojan came out and charged $189. And the people it targeted were people that had sensitive data that was their research. If you were able to target the mass consumer and strictly go after their pictures and their videos, I'm pretty sure everyone has a significant other who's got over 10,000 pictures and videos that if somebody was able to lock all that up and you didn't have backups, et cetera, and all they asked for was $100, you'd say $100 is totally worth it. And if you could target 10 million people for $100 and get even 10% of them to pay, that's a lot of money.
It's a good tie together. I would challenge that if you hit enough people using iCloud or something along those lines, do you want to pick a battle with Apple? Do you want to pick a battle with Google? Because if you hit enough of their consumers and it hurts them, that's not a battle I want. Those companies are good at what they do.
And it leads to the power, the fading fallacy that cloud security is less secure than on-premise. Perhaps a topic for another day.
Oh, this was great. I appreciate it. I think it's an interesting one. It's very top of mind. And if you haven't seen the word ransomware out there, you know, ransomware.
Coming to a theater near you. When theaters are back.
As always, you can, we want to hear your feedback. Please let us know thoughts on the topic of the day. If you have other topics you'd like us to cover or just comments, you can email us at feedback@greatsecuritydebate.net or go to our website, greatsecuritydebate.net. We're also on Twitter @securitydebate. You can subscribe to the podcast on any of your favorite podcast applications. There's links to them all on our website and how to subscribe, or you can listen to them on the web on our website. We look forward to seeing you again next time. And thanks again, Brian and Eric, for another great security debate.